My name is Cable Green. I'm the Director of Technology at the Ohio Learning Network. Welcome to the TeachU Online Seminar Series. This is a free online seminar series that we run in Ohio, and the primary purpose of it is to highlight what's going on in the state as a professional development activity. That was how it started, but it quickly, because it's online and it's free, it has since become somewhat of a global event, and we're thrilled to have some folks outside the state of Ohio today. We're going to go over just a few housekeeping items. First of all, welcome to everybody that's coming in, and I'm going to, just to make sure that everyone's speakers are working, I'm going to type into the chat window. Can you all hear me? And make sure that everybody's speakers are all right. We're going to take just a moment and do a quick round of introductions. And to keep this short, if everybody would just type into the chat window who you are, where you're from, if you're at an institution of higher education or really from or from any other business, please include who you work for, and maybe just a quick note about why you're interested. So I'll hop off the mic for just a second. If everybody could take a moment, just type in that chat window again, your full name, where you're from, and your interest in tonight's session. That'll give us an idea of who we've got in the audience. While you're doing that, let me also say that we had 54 folks sign up for this event, even though it was at 7 p.m. at night. I don't expect we'll get all 54 tonight, but we will be recording this session, and I'm going to start that recording in just a moment. And actually, I'm just going to go ahead and do that right now. So, Heather, we are recording, and I have received over 50 emails just in the last week of folks letting me know that they wanted to come view the archive. So we will have a lot of traffic on this archive, if not this evening, soon. Laura, I can see you've got your hand raised. Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. I can't seem to get my chat to work.
That's a great question, and I've got some orientation slides in just a moment that we'll be going over. So if you could hold that question, I'll get right to it.
Thank you.
All right. As I said, I just have a few orientation slides. For those of you who are not familiar with Illuminate or might not have used it before, here are just a few pointers that will help you get the most out of this experience and make good use of this tool. The first thing that you'll want to do is to scale up your whiteboard so that you'll have full screen resolution. And if you just look at the screen, the way you do this is to click on Tools, pull down to Whiteboard, and then you want to check Scale to Window. So Tools, Whiteboard, pull down to Scale to Window. That will blow up your whiteboard nice and big, and you'll be in good shape. Next thing you'll want to do is to set your connection speed to make sure that it's optimized for wherever you are. So for example, if you're at home and you're on a cable modem, you'll want to select cable DSL. Or if you're in your office, like I am here in Columbus, you'll want to select LAN. And that's just session connection speed, and then select the appropriate connection speed. Several of you have already found the raising your hand, but wanted to point this out. Up in the upper left, you'll see all the participants that are in the session. And just to the lower left of that window, you'll see a little hand with a green arrow pointing up. If everybody could click on that, please, and raise their hand. When that happens, all of the moderators are alerted, and this is a great way to throw your hand up when you've got a question for the moderators, and I'll go ahead and put everybody's hands down. Thanks very much. And that way we'll know who to call on and in what order. So if we ask you to throw your hands up and when it's time to ask questions, that's how you do it. Many of you have already tested your microphone, but if when you ask your question or interacting with folks during tonight's discussion, if you'd like to use the audio tool, that's in the very lower left-hand corner. I currently have the settings set so that only one speaker can speak at a time, and so as long as somebody has the mic, no one else can speak. That will reduce the feedback loops that we'll get in the system. And so, but if you do have the mic, you have to remember to give it up when you're done speaking. And if you forget, the moderators will take it away from you and then give it back. So we've got you covered. Text windows, I think you've all found that as well. But I forget, somebody had the question, Laura, I think it was wondering about how do you chat, the way you do your text chat. And I see Laura just put her hand up again. The way you do a text chat is just under the text chat window where you see all the chat. Let me grab my finger here. Right here where it's circled red, where it says how are you, that's how, where you would actually type in, and you can just hit the enter key or click on send, and your text chat will be sent. The follow-up to that is that you can direct your text chat. So you'll see that there's a window or a pull-down menu just under where you type in your text chat, and you can send a private message to someone, and only they will see it. However, all of the moderators in the room do have the ability to see private messages. So do know that if you send private messages, the moderators are seeing it, although it will not be part of the archived session. The thing we want to point out is we may run some quick polls. Michael and Stephen may ask you for a quick vote or a show of, rather than a show of hands, it may be more helpful for them to ask you to click either on the green check or a red X, and we can do an A through E type situation as well. But if you look up at the very top of your screen, you'll see the green check and the red X in the toolbar. If everybody could click on either the green check or the red X so that we know that you see that, wonderful. Thanks very much. And then what we can do in turn is do this kind of thing. Let's see here if I can say publish stats to the whiteboard. And that'll give us a quick show of who has what opinion on particular topics. Okay. At this point, thanks everybody for introducing themselves on the chat window. We appreciate it. You have all come to this session to hear about EduPatents, the Gathering Storm. And we have two speakers tonight, Stephen Downs and Michael Feldstein. I've already introduced myself. I'm Cable Green. I'm the Director of Technology at the Ohio Learning Network. And before I continue, and in the interest of full disclosure, I need to let this group know that I am a member of the Blackboard Merger Advisory Council. This is a group of Blackboard's large clients around the world to help advise them on moving forward. And as being part of that group, I have signed an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement. So I need to let all of you know that there's any information that I learned in those meetings, I cannot share with this group or with anybody else outside of that council. And the reason I share this with you is because we will be talking about the Blackboard patent. I can see that Matt Small just joined us from Blackboard. Matt's the lead attorney at Blackboard. And is here to help contribute to the discussion as well. The main reason that I share that with you is that if you think that there may be an opportunity for you to contribute to the discussion or to maybe push a question that I'm not doing, feel free to do so, because there's certain information that I cannot share. And I share that with you, again, in the interest of full disclosure. Now, more importantly, what I'd like to do is introduce our speakers tonight, Stephen Downs and Michael Feldstein. You can see a little bit of information here about them, but if you look down at the URLs at the bottom of the whiteboard, there are all their bios are up there. Stephen Downs has lived and worked in Canada for quite some time before joining the National Research Council as a senior researcher. Stephen's currently based in New Brunswick at the Institute for Information Technology E-Learning Research Group, where Stephen's become a leading voice in the area of learning objects, metadata, and the emerging fields of web logs in education and content syndication. Stephen is perhaps one of the best known folks, or is best known for his daily research newsletter called OL Daily, short for Online Learning Daily, which reaches thousands of readers across Canada and around the world. and we welcome Stephen. Michael Feldstein is currently the Assistant Director of Blended Learning at the SUNY Learning Network. Michael's been involved with designing and developing e-learning and knowledge management solutions for corporations and universities for more than a decade. He was an active member of the open source community around MIT's .learn CMS during its early phases of development. In 2001, Michael acted as the interim CLO, Chief Learning Officer, for the Otter Group, and more recently served as CEO for Mindwires, a training and knowledge management consulting company. And Michael serves as a member of eLearn Magazine's editorial advisory board. As of December 1st, Michael will be taking on a new position as Principal Product Manager for the Oracle Academic Enterprise Initiative at Oracle Corporation. And that's just a quick bit about these two gentlemen. And now let me tell you a little bit about the format for tonight. What we'll be doing is, for the most part, treating this like a talk radio show. We've got lots of bright folks in the audience. These two gentlemen are well-versed in multiple topics that have to do with edupatents and all of the implications thereof. And so to open this up, what we're going to do is start with Stephen Downs. And Stephen's going to take 10, 15 minutes to talk about what his position is on these topics and to point out what he believes to be the most important and most salient points that we should be paying attention to in the discussing later this evening. Michael will then do the same thing. And then we're going to open it up to a broader conversation where we'll have a lot of interaction between Michael and Stephen. I'll be prompting them with a variety of questions throughout. And then, of course, we invite you, the audience, to use the chat window especially, but also raising your hands when appropriate to ask questions yourself. As the moderator, I do ask that if you are willing to type in your question, that will help with the flow of the discussion, because I will hold on to those questions and then feed them out to the presenters. But if you do have a question that you've just got to ask, go ahead and throw your hand up, and you're welcome to do so. At this point, let me turn it over to Stephen. I'll get off the mic, and Stephen, it's all yours.
And greetings to everyone from Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada, where it is dark and 8:11 p.m. and about 4 degrees Celsius. And for those of you who like Fahrenheit, that's about 38 degrees. And Michael, I want to congratulate you on your new position. I'm sure you'll find it an interesting one and a different world from where you were. The topic for today, of course, is the Blackboard patents. I think pretty well everybody here in the audience has heard about the Blackboard patents. I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail. Michael will be presenting a pretty good analysis of that, and we will be talking through the show about exactly what that patent entails. But in broad strokes, Blackboard has patented aspects of learning management systems, and the predominant objection that has come in choruses from around the education community is that what Blackboard has patented has been, in fact, been discovered independently by numerous agencies and not something that was discovered or invented by Blackboard. And indeed, one of the very first reactions to the announcement of the patent and the subsequent announcement of the lawsuit against Desire to Learn was the creation of a Wikipedia page listing a directory of prior art. And Cable, you can start launching those websites now if you want. In particular, the people from eCollege argued that they had, in fact, developed and announced the development of very similar sorts of things well prior to the filing of the Blackboard patent. And BECTA, which is the British agency that looks at learning and especially e-learning, is on record as saying that Blackboard's claims, quote, could not be considered novel, unquote. a lot of people, Alfred Essa among them, think of the Blackboard patent as potentially being more a response to open source than anything. Essa said in his blog that the patent and the lawsuit was a shot across the bow of open source. The argument here is, and you know, Blackboard is on record as saying that they won't go after open source, but the argument here is that Blackboard does not need to go after open source because with the fear, uncertainty, and doubt, and confusion, and chaos caused by the filing of the patent and the launching of the lawsuit, university and college administrators who are notoriously conservative will shy away from open source solutions. And so Blackboard doesn't need to do anything. The conservative university administrations will do that for them. On the other hand, we've had the argument from a few quarters that we should welcome this development. It's kind of like welcoming our new Blackboard overlords. Scott Wilson, for example, is and some others are pointing out and saying, you know, perhaps people like Tony Carrere are right and that we are at the point of technology disruption. The idea here is that the Blackboard patent and lawsuit moves us from the relatively stagnant age of the learning management system to what might be called the next generation of learning environments, which is the personal learning environment. And so we'll be moving away from large content management systems, which are instantiated and exemplified by learning management systems like Blackboard, to much more lightweight, individually controlled, and flexible things like personal learning environments and supporting technologies such as blogs, wikis, content management systems, and other things. And if you scroll down on the Scott's Work blog page, you can see a diagram explaining what is meant by this. Once the patent is filed, we see that customer demand begins to drop and drops quite a bit below the supply of virtual learning environments. And at the same time, because of the lawsuit, there's an increase in the supply of personal learning environments. And at the point where those two things cross, we reach a tipping point where the market shifts from being one of predominantly learning management systems to being one of predominantly personal learning environments. And that may be good news, and certainly pedagogically I think it probably is good news, but the point remains, and I think it's an essential point to underline, many people believe that Blackboard did not invent the learning management system, did not genuinely invent the things that they're claiming in their patent. And this is not just my opinion, this is an opinion that is being echoed across the blogosphere and across the education technology community. And so there's a concern not just about the learning management system, but about a repetition of this pattern. And again, Michael, when he talks, is going to talk not simply about the Blackboard patent, but the large number of similar patents and the possibility of future patents. And Blackboard itself has already announced in its own media releases that it intends to pursue a path following the principles outlined under the heading of e-learning 2.0. And certainly I think that there would be a concern that all educators and all education technology developers would worry about that Blackboard would claim to have invented significant parts of this technology as well. The thing is, with the patents, the mere threat is often enough to get companies and organizations to give up, because the potential threat, the liability is so large and the patents are so broad that taking them to court is, if you will, a coin toss. And the concern is that the logical result of, you know, the successful defense of this patent would be essentially a monopolization not only of the learning management system space, but of the educational technology space as a whole. And I think that that would not be welcomed to by educators as a whole. There have been a lot of discussions, meta-level discussions, if you will, about not simply the merits of the Blackboard patent, but the mechanism which allowed something like this to happen in the first place, and in particular the United States patent system. It's been noted that the patent system is dealing with 500,000 applications and a 10-year delay. and it's currently allowing sweeping business methods and software patents. This is why we see such an opposition to software patents and related legislation in Europe. The concern there, and they've expressed it in the No Education Patents, No Software Patents page in Europe, it pushes the cost of applications higher. It creates a negative effect, countering the development of in-house and open source development, especially in smaller institutions and small and medium-sized enterprises. And it deters and possibly prevents the rollout of freedom and open source software in education, in the education environment. And this, of course, raises the cost of accessing an education for students. Now, it's possibly the case that Blackboard wasn't expecting this, but I think it's pretty clear that we've seen the education community fighting back and fighting back hard. We've got Desire to Learn, of course, which was possibly supposed to just roll over and pay licensing fees, but instead responding by fighting the lawsuit. And they've posted a patent lawsuit information page. We've got EDUCAUSE, where the board of EDUCAUSE unanimously called on Blackboard to drop the lawsuit against Desire to Learn. They're arguing that the patent is not good for education, it's not good for the participation in corporations in educational technology, and it's a betrayal of the community that has come together in order to develop applications like learning management systems. They point out that ideas were freely exchanged in discussions and meetings prior to the deployment of learning management systems, and therefore this is not something that one company among all of them should be patenting. That's essentially what I have to say about this, and I'm going to turn over the microphone now and the discussion to Michael Feldstein.
Thank you, Stephen. Good to be with all of you tonight. First of all, a disclaimer and an apology. The disclaimer, I am currently, until next Thursday, an employee of the SUNY Learning Network. As of Friday, I will be an employee of Oracle Corporation. And both organizations would ask me to clarify that I am not speaking for them. I am here as the author of the Illiterate Weblog, speaking from my own perspective. That's the disclaimer. The apology is I have a bit of a cold today. I hope that's not coming through. I have sitting next to me a nice steaming cup of a great herbal tea mix called Fleminade, which I hope will solve any potential problems. But if you hear any coughing or sneezing, I do apologize in advance. I just want to hit a couple of quick points before we go to discussion. When this news first hit in early August, late July really, there were a lot of us just didn't have any real background in patent law. I certainly didn't. And so there was a lot of back and forth about, well, what does this really mean, and do we have the expertise, and who does? Since that time, some experts have weighed in, and I think it's important for us to be aware of some of the comments that have come from lawyers, from software business folks, and so on and so forth. And so I'd just like to share a couple of those with you. Here are a couple of quotes. Two of these come from an excellent podcasting series on John Mayer's blog. I see that John is in the audience tonight, and I highly recommend his blog if you're at all interested in law, as I have become, much to my surprise. So the first quote is from Vince Chiappetta, IP law professor at Willamette University College, who John asked to look over the Blackboard patent. And he said, the system and method claims are very broadly written. I was pretty amazed at first blush at what ended up there. The EDUCAUSE letter, to which Stephen referred and to which I'll be going into more detail shortly, said, EDUCAUSE engaged the services of a highly reputable independent law firm to review the patent. The preliminary conclusion is that the patent was very broadly defined and was inappropriately approved by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. So a couple of legal experts weighing in on the breadth of the patent. And then also from one of John's podcasts, Professor Mary LaFrance, William S. Boyd Professor of Law at University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and this is an important point. Blackboard can sue a user for patent infringement. Blackboard's strategy is probably to discourage universities from developing their own system because the threat of litigation could cause some universities to terminate those efforts. That, again, coming not from the EduBlog community, but coming from an intellectual property law expert. Now, I want to return to that. I hope we'll return to that a little later in our conversation. Blackboard has said very clearly that they are not interested in suing end users, that it would be against their interest. And I am certainly not in a position to make definitive statements about their motives in this. But I will just say for the moment two things. One, as long as a patent exists, management can change, the patent can be sold, and so on and so forth. So regardless of the intentions of the company at the moment, the threat of the patent is tied to its mere existence. The other thing I would say, and again, I hope we'll come back to this later, is that there is a model, in fact, for industries that want to sue their customers and want to keep their hands clean. If you think about the music publishers' relationships with the RIAA, I think there's a pretty clear model, and maybe we can talk later on about the Software and Information Industry Association, SIAA, and how that could potentially serve the same purpose. Moving on, I'd like to share with you one view on software patents. Here, I'm going to be a little coy and withhold the author of this quote until the second slide. I will say it was written in 1994. And I, as a preface, I'd like to say that what's really important here is not Blackboard's particular patent. And in my own mind, it's not even whether Blackboard's patent is valid or not. I happen to share the opinion voiced by Stephen and by some of the people quoted in the last slide that it probably is too broad and not valid. But my greatest fear is that someone will bring an undeniably valid patent to bear in the EduPatent educational community, because I think it will have disastrous effects. So one of the things I hope we'll talk about tonight is the impact of patent assertion on the economic market that is the educational software market. So anyway, to read the slide, patent law provides to inventors an exclusive right to new technology in return for publication of the technology. This is not appropriate for industries such as software development, in which innovations occur rapidly, can be made without substantial capital investment, and tend to be creative combinations of previously known techniques. The U.S. software industry has evolved to a multi-billion dollar industry that leads the world in productivity and accounts for a substantial portion of U.S. GNP. The software industry has advanced the efficiency of other industries through the proliferation of computing and computer-controlled processes. All of these gains, remember this was written in 1994, have come prior to the application of patent process to software and consequently without protection for software. There is no justification for a policy that would not only drain capital resources, which are better spent on software development, into patent applications and other legal fees, and also actually serve to reduce innovation by limiting the availability of previously developed techniques. Okay, now I'm going to reveal who this is from. In 16 years, Oracle Corporation has grown from a startup company with a handful of employees to the world's third largest independent software producer employing 8,000 people. And by the way, this slide has nothing to do with the fact that I'm about to go work for Oracle. It just speaks to the point I want to make. Oracle filed its first patent application in November 1991, not because it felt its software was suddenly worthy of patent protection. It filed that application because of concerns that other inventors afforded patent protection by a flawed patent system might find themselves in a position to seriously weaken the company's competitive edge by alleging infringement. Even if Oracle had developed a certain invention first and could produce the appropriate prior art to prove its case, thousands of dollars in attorney's fees and other expenses would be spent in defense of its rightfully owned technology. Oracle consequently believes that it must have a patent portfolio with which to respond to potential aggressors so as to settle them by cross-licensing to avoid litigation. Oracle is forced to channel a significant portion of its financial resources into a patent protection of its assets rather than using those resources in further innovating and expanding its computer software products. Oracle Corporation opposes the patentability of software. The company believes that the existing copyright law and available trade secret protections, as opposed to patent law, are better suited to protecting computer software developments. That policy was issued in 1994. It stands today. At the time that that policy was issued, Oracle had a market capitalization of roughly 10 times the size of what Blackboard's is today. Since that, in the ensuing 12 years, Oracle has grown to be more than 100 times the market capitalization of Blackboard today. 2 points there. One is that they were able to do all that without ever resorting to the strategy currently being employed by Blackboard. And believe me, it wasn't because of lack of competition. And two, even when they were a company 10 times the size of Blackboard, they were concerned about the financial impact, the detrimental financial impact of having a focus on patent litigation and intellectual property protection rather than putting those resources into innovation. That was a company 10 times the size of Blackboard. Desire to Learn is certainly significantly smaller than Blackboard. And I'm probably overstaying my talk time here, but I just want to take a minute, since it's came up before, to talk about what that economic impact really is. One more slide back. These are based on numbers estimated from the Desire to Learn, a privately held company. And unless there are some D2L employees in the audience today, I know there are, but who want to make news by telling us their private numbers, all I can tell you is that these are estimates, and I have no inside information. They only need to be within an order of magnitude of the true numbers in order to make the point I'm trying to make, and I'm fairly confident that they are. Most estimates of this lawsuit is that it'll cost Desire to Learn somewhere between $1.5 and $3 million to litigate to conclusion. That is $1.5 to $3 million before it's decided that they're decided the merits of the case. Okay, that's just to get to have the trial, to have the case considered. The public estimates in the business media are the D2L's annual revenue is around $10 million. I'm just going to assume that's roughly right, and let's use U.S. dollars for the sake of argument. We know that industry average for LMS companies is about 5% for profits, so that would make D2L's annual profits somewhere around $500,000 a year, $500,000. So if these numbers are anywhere near right, Desire to Learn is going to spend 3 to 6 years of their 100% of their profits just getting to the point where a judge and jury can decide whether Blackboard's patents is valid. Now, if they lose, they'll pay that $1.5 to $3 million. They'll pay it if they win, too, by the way. Plus, they'll pay whatever royalty Blackboard is asking, plus treble damages for willful infringement. The law says that if you knowingly infringe on a patent, you can be punished with treble damages. Since Blackport has informed D2L that they are infringing, from that time forward, they will pay those treble damages if they lose. I've seen some calculations that would put that at around $800,000 per new customer from suit to settlement. Plus, they'll have to pay Blackboard's legal fees. So I think you can see that as a mechanism for resolving, even if you buy that patents in software are valid and in general, and that Blackboard has a right to protect their intellectual property claims, you have to ask yourself whether this mechanism is going to be one that is really going to serve the education market in the sense of making sure that valid claims are validated and invalid claims are not. Can anyone really afford to fight this fight? Or to put it another way, if another company had come out with this claim in 1996, would there be either a Blackboard or a desire to learn? Would they be able to afford to develop and innovate in that environment? And I will pass the mic now to our fine moderator, Cable Green.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, for framing the issue. And at this point, I want to remind our audience, start cooking up your questions. And as you conceive them, please do type them into the chat window, and I will start to gather them and fire them at these two gentlemen for you. And again, if you have a burning question or want to throw in a comment, just throw your hand up and we'll get right to you. Both of you alluded to this and other patents affecting or possibly affecting innovation, in particular open source innovation. And I'd like you to address that topic in any way you'd like, really on two fronts. One, on open source software, and the second on open source content initiatives. As we've all seen, following MIT's lead, multiple institutions of higher education around the world, most recently the Open University in England, have been making pronouncements about open courseware and opening that up. I'm wondering what you think this and other edge of patents like this one, how they affect open source software and potentially open courseware initiatives as well.
The open content initiatives. One of the concerns that I have about an initiative like this Blackboard patent is that it will tend over time to reduce the competition in this space. And in particular, it will have an impact against open source software and software, how do I want to describe it? I don't want to say non-commercial software, but software that allows for the provision of open educational resources or free educational resources, because the payment of license fees will create an overhead cost. And when you create an overhead cost, such as license fees, then you're making it that much more difficult to distribute open educational resources. It's like a tax on free content, right? It's like a tax on giving things to poor people, if you will. And so this sets up a situation both with the tax on free content and with the larger monopolization of the market space, where the dominant player in that space also becomes the dominant provider of content in that space. And if you look at what Blackboard has been doing, Blackboard has signed a series of agreements with commercial publishers in order to provide their content through the Blackboard system to educational institutions and to students. And the presumption is here that students will purchase access or have that access purchased for them by the university, which will then charge them, of course, and through the Blackboard system. So Blackboard becomes not simply the software provider, but also the content provider, and the content provider in a very closed market and a market that is not friendly to free content. So I think there's certainly a concern that needs to be expressed here. And I'll leave it now to Michael to take over the other patents question, although I do want to raise one very similar patent in this space that has a very similar effect, and that's the patents that are held by ContentGuard in the field of digital rights management. You might recall that ContentGuard's patent, again, it's one of these ridiculously sweeping patents, covers the expression of digital rights in a language. And I personally do not know of another way to express digital rights. And again, this constitutes a tax on free content, because even in order to say that it's free, that other people can use it, which you need to do in order to avoid potential litigation, you need to express the rights associated with that, whether they be Creative Commons or public domain or GPL or whatever. You need to express those rights in some sort of language, and for them to be that expression to be useful, it needs to be a language that has a syntax that can be read by, say, a machine. And so the DRM patents are, again, a tax on free content. And in my view, this is why there's been so much opposition to the ContentGuard patents, and why there's been the development of an alternative and competing digital rights management or digital rights expression language, which is the Open Digital Rights Language. And Michael, I'll turn it to you now.
First, let me address the open source issue. Stephen is absolutely right regarding the transaction cost, that if you want to release software now, open source, you're going to have to do some research and spend the money to make sure that you are not going to be sued for infringement. It's even, I think, worse than that in some cases. So, for example, I noticed that we have a UMUC person in the audience tonight. UMUC runs its own learning management system, homegrown WebTyco. As far as I know, doesn't distribute it to anyone, but nevertheless represents a large chunk of business, and in theory could be served with a cease and desist order. I mentioned earlier that the RIAA provides a model, and the Software and Information Industry Association is a great potential bridge for that model, where you don't want to sue your customers, so you get a third party to do it. SIIA, which actually does a lot of things, not all of which are bad, but one of the things that they are is essentially they issue bounties for copyright, not for copyright, for software piracy. So if you have a pirate copy of Microsoft Office on your machine and your coworker rats you out, that coworker gets a bounty, essentially, to the SIAA, and the SIAA then gets a certain amount of money from Microsoft. You could see very easily where that could translate to, say, let's imagine that Moodle was found to infringe on a patent, and you're looking for guerrilla instances of Moodle. So there is a very real danger of anyone being sued, and if there's money involved, being sued for money, if there's not money changing hands, could still be sued for cease and desist. And you would be surprised at how broad this can be. For example, Jacobson v. Katzer, a current lawsuit, professor in California, I believe, developed software to control model trains, released it as open source software, and is being sued for patent infringement. This is a problem we're not going to get away from. We're not going to design around it. We're not going to come up with alternatives for it. If you go for the social software, you're going to end up, for example, having to deal with maybe the Friendster patent, which is on a system, method, and apparatus for connecting users in an online computer system based on their relationship with social networks. Patents are a reality of our lives right now with software, and open source software companies are going to have to spend, or open source software projects are going to have to spend more money and put more effort in. They're going to have to develop indemnification clauses for their customers. They're going to have to develop contributor licenses so that you're protected if you contribute to open source software. And it's going to be there's going to be a general dampening effect. And in fragile markets like the educational software market, where the profit margins aren't that great and the volume isn't that great, they're going to be disproportionately damaged. Let me just answer the other question briefly about the timeline. Let's see if I have, I think I have a slide here. Yep. Okay. So jury selection begins February 11th, 2008 for the Blackboard v. Desire to Learn suit. Between now and then, something known as a Markman hearing takes place, which essentially decides the scope of the patent. There is a maneuver, and I'm not suggesting that this is what's going to happen, but just people, when people ask how long this could take, an increasingly common strategy is for organizations to try to invalidate a patent not through the through the courts, but through the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. You can file a request for reconsideration. There are a couple of different flavors of that, which I won't get into now. Generally, what happens when those are filed is that the litigation halts while the court waits for the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office to issue its ruling. That can delay things by a couple of years. Bottom line is, you know, if we're lucky, it'll be 2 years. Could be 3, 4, 5 years, and you should be aware that in the jurisdiction where this case will be tried, 70% of patent cases are found in favor of the plaintiff. So I'll release the mic now to Cable.
And again, I'd invite the audience to type in your questions, and we will slip those right in. Just a follow-up to the open source question, what specifically do you think that the Blackboard patent could possibly mean to open source development, specifically with some of the leaders in that open source movement? And I'm speaking specifically of Sakai, Moodle, maybe .learn, and ELGG, which also bridges into the personal learning environment discussion that Stephen brought up. But let me stick to this question. What specifically, or what impact might this have on Moodle, Sakai, ELGG, and .learn as institutions look at adopting them as their primary means of delivering online courses?
Well, I think...
that question about... Go ahead, Mike.
Oh, I was just going to say that you're very likely to see adoption slow for all of the platforms as universities that are looking to make the jump decide to wait and see what's happening. From what I saw at the last EDUCAUSE meeting, there's a group of universities that have already decided they're going to look. They're already doing that. Then there's another whole class of universities that were thinking about looking, haven't gotten started. They're probably going to sit for a while. We don't know in terms of the legal impact of the patent directly, you know, whether there's going to be a lawsuit, you know, if these products infringe and so on and so forth. Probably ELG is in the least danger since it doesn't appear, and I'm no ELG expert any more than I'm a legal expert, but it doesn't appear to have the same permission structure as a typical LMS. But, you know, people have to be concerned about it, and it's going to slow down adoption and probably also going to slow down vendor uptake. Go ahead, Stephen.
Wanted to make the point that I asked this question about Sakai, and I got an email back from Sakai Board Chair Joseph Harden, who took pains to note that they were working not only with the Software Freedom Law Center, but also with the developers of Moodle and A-Tutor, and that they weren't looking to settle or to strike some sort of agreement that would benefit only Sakai. And so I think we're seeing a fairly broad spectrum response from the open source community, and I certainly haven't noticed any slowdown in the development of these softwares. I was talking about 2 hours ago with someone from IBM, and now, IBM is supporting, is in an initiative supporting Sakai, and of course, Sakai has received support from other companies as well as the major universities that make up the consortium. And so, you know, I think that we're seeing, if anything, more support being brought forward in support of open source rather than less. So there may be a slowdown in adoption, but I certainly don't see the slowdown in development. And if anything, I see a more aggressive development. I found it interesting as well. After the lawsuit was announced, and you know the patent and lawsuit was announced, what we next saw was a flurry of orders being taken by Desire to Learn for deployment of its learning management system in various places. And if anything, the publicity that Desire to Learn got as a result of this lawsuit may have, you know, may well, I won't say compensate for the cost, because the costs are pretty large, but will certainly help defray some of the costs. And we've seen, again, an increased uptake for Desire to Learn. I guess if Desire to Learn is worth suing, then the opinion is on the part of some people who are purchasing LMSs that they're worth buying as well, or at least certainly considering.
Yeah, I saw someone earlier, it might have been John, make a similar comment about the numbers. And again, unless Desire to Learn wants to come forward and make news today by announcing their numbers, I do think it's important to think about the numbers that I laid out earlier and then add whatever multiplier you think makes sense for the goodwill that they've gotten, you know. Maybe it increased their sales by 25%, and then also calculate the sales cycle and that it takes a good year to 2 years to sell one of these things, and see what their net looks like. My sense, I'm not a math guy, but my sense is that the numbers still look very daunting. For any company that is the size that all these LMS companies are. It's just really bad math. And while I think it's great that this has created some positive attention for Desire to Learn, and while I certainly wouldn't want to characterize their financial their particular financial situation, about which I know very little. They're closely held, and I have no idea what their, you know, relationship is with their investors, other than that their public statements that they are prepared to weather the storm. I think it is important for us to all understand that the financial impact of this on any company, Desire to Learn, Angel, Moodle Rooms, R-Smart, whoever it is, could be very, very serious. And this is the kind of thing that puts can put companies out of business.
I'd like to have a cloud moment that I had a few moments back and identify Mike King as the person I was talking to on the other show.
And Stephen, you'd mentioned that you might be recording pieces of that, or is that something that you'd like to broadcast now, or that you'd like to direct us to in the future once that archive is put up on EdTech Talk? While Stephen's thinking about that, I'd like to pick up on a thread that we've hit two or three times but haven't really jumped into yet. And I've heard it put several different ways, but one of them is that this may be an opportunity to take a look at redefining the way that course management is done. And John Mayer asks, aren't LMSs dead? Let me open that up a little bit. Stephen, Michael?
Stephen, you want to go first? I suspect that Stephen may be having some audio problems, so I'll just jump right in and maybe he can chime in a little later. And this is an area where he and I may have some contrasting perspectives. There are two questions. I see he's back. Stephen, you want to take the mic?
Ed, Michael, we'll let you start.
Okay. There are a number of issues here. When you ask the question, aren't LMSs dead? There's the question of fact. Are LMSs in fact fading in the market? And then there's the question of desire, goals, appropriateness. Should LMSs be fading in the market? I think whatever you think your position is on the desires and goals, I think the fact is that LMSs, even though it's a very difficult business to be in, the LMS software category is still doing very well. Institutions are still adopting, whether it's Desire to Learn or Blackboard or Moodle or Sakai, still adopting learning management systems at a pretty good clip. And there are lots of reasons for that related to institutional missions and middle accreditation and decision-making structures in university, some of which make eminent sense and some of which make no sense at all, and much of which are somewhere in between. I am not aware of LMSs being on a downturn. To the contrary, some recent EDUCAUSE figures that I saw indicated that there is more churn in LMSs than was expected, that people were not getting rid of LMSs, but changing up LMSs every few years, which anyone who's been through one of these migrations knows is hideously painful, and people don't do it unless they think they have to. Now, the question about whether LMSs should exist is more of a philosophical one. I'll lay out where I come from. My personal passion about all of this is that it is about two things. One, it's about increasing access to education by helping good face-to-face teachers be good online teachers. And I am very much a believer in teachers. I am not a believer in, I don't think there's any conflict between great teacher and self-directed students. But I believe that there's a strong role for teachers in the equation and that there always will be. And so my passion is focused on helping teachers help students. And so again, there's the first point of making good classroom teachers into good online teachers. And the other is in particularly in higher education, where we don't always place adequate emphasis on teaching professors how to teach, on helping, I don't think you're ever going to make a bad teacher into a great teacher, but you can make a fair teacher into a good teacher and a good teacher into a great teacher. And I think there's a role for tools in doing this. I think there's a role for in affordances that the environment puts in front of you that encourages you to see things differently. And I also think that if you're really going to achieve wide-scale improvement in this way, that there has to be institutional support. It's not going to happen without it. So I believe in systems that an institution can support, and that means something that looks vaguely like a learning management system. Does it look much like the tools that we have today? Probably not. I think we're in our infancy in figuring out what it needs to look like. But I do believe in centralized systems, and I do believe in centralized support of those systems. I'm done.
Stephen, anything you want to add to that before I move us?
Working right now.
Yeah, you're coming through loud and clear. Go ahead.
Okay, good. My button keeps going up and down on its own. this newfangled technology is just too much for me. No, I'm kidding. Look, empirically, the evidence is pretty solid that there's no real downturn in the learning management system market right now. I mean, you go out there, you look, just about every institution of any size has a learning management system. Even small schools and colleges are getting learning management systems through statewide or province-wide licensing agreements. And so, there's widespread penetration into this market. And there's no real sign, at least from my perspective, that institutions are migrating away from learning management systems into some other technology. And indeed, when you look at the alternatives, and the alternatives that I've looked at and talked a lot about over the last few years, the Web 2.0 type alternatives, if you will, blogs and wikis and things like that, to a large degree, these technologies are actually blocked by the institutions in question. Especially at the K-12 level, but even at the college and university level in some cases. And consequently, for many instructors, for many educators, there isn't an alternative except to use the learning management system. And so that's a bit of a concern. But on the other hand, it's also pretty good evidence that the LMS isn't going anywhere right away. And, I think there's a variety of reasons why institutions would favor things like the learning management system and similar technologies rather than things like blogs and wikis and other things. And my own attitude is that the institutions are not willing to give up on the management and control that an LMS affords them. And indeed, you look at the development of LMS technology, the actual presentation of the course material hasn't changed a whole lot in the last 10 years. I might point out, several years before any such lawsuit or any such patent application, I should say. But a lot has changed in the back end as these learning management systems become more and more tightly integrated with the student information systems and other educational management software. Now, I think when we look at whether the question of learning management systems should exist, this is where I really do run into a disagreement with Michael, because I'm not an advocate of the centralized approach, and indeed, it's not clear to me that as the educational technology and online learning evolves, that institutions are as important as they have been in the past. More and more, we are seeing that new educational technology makes it possible for people to learn outside the institutional environment. And we look at things like Jay Cross talking about informal learning. Even with Mike King in the previous discussion on IBM is looking at informal learning. So we're seeing more and more of this take place outside the institutional context. Michael talks about improving access by helping face-to-face teachers be good online teachers. My own take is, education, learning as a labor-intensive endeavor doesn't scale. We live in a world of 6 billion people, not 600 million. And we just do not have the resources to put on the ground enough teachers to meet the demand for that. It's just not going to happen. We just can't afford to pay for that. And consequently, I think that where the real affordance is with the distributed learning technology is in not in improving the capacities of current teachers, but rather in helping everybody in whatever role they happen to play take on some of the tasks, some of the responsibilities of being teachers, so that you can be a practitioner and a teacher at the same time. But in order to make that work, you have to go outside the learning management system environment. You have to go to an environment where you have multiple simultaneous providers. And, you know, this is what I've characterized as e-learning 2.0. But again, either way, we don't get away from this issue. Either way, we're still looking at the problem of patents, at the problem of people coming up with and getting a patent on an idea that is obvious to the entire community and going out there and claiming it as their very own. And, you know, until we address that problem, and in my view, until we address that problem, not legally, because there might not be legal recourse, certainly not in the current U.S. environment, but as a community, by responding with some sort of solidarity against the actions taken by an organization that would do such a thing, until we're able to come up with some sort of coherent response, we're going to be hit again and again and again with this sort of thing. And we have to declare as a community that we're simply not going to take it, that we will not allow companies to patent part of our community space, and that they will be punished by not being patronized, not being supported.
Amen, Brother Stephen. I think regardless of the philosophical debates and differences, the reality is that there's no running from this fight. And the reality is that this is not just about Blackboard. And the reality is that nothing is good is going to come of this unless the educational institutions stick together. And I really also hope that we will talk about what folks can do, because this is really a situation where you need to do some things, particularly if you're a Blackboard customer. I've spoken to a number of Blackboard customers who have expressed anger to me about what's going on, and when I've asked them, well, what does Blackboard say when you tell them this? They've said, well, we haven't told them. So we need to respond to this. We need to take it seriously. We need to mobilize some efforts to let those vendors in our who are supporting our efforts as teachers know what we need and what we must have from them.
I'm looking
also,
at all the. Oh, go ahead,
Michael. Steve. You drew the parallel earlier with the RIAA, and you know, that's not such a bad parallel, because on the one hand, we have the recording industry, you know, suing its customers like crazy, but on the other hand, we have the customers basically, I don't want to say ignoring this, but you know, continuing with their file sharing despite this, and basically telling the music industry what it can do with their DRM and with their lawsuits, to the point where, well, in Canada, we had a number of our most prominent musicians break away from the Canadian equivalent of the RIAA and say to the media and to their fans, we don't want to sue you. We want you to copy our music. We want you to share our music. And so, you know, I mean, we need to keep in mind that we are not only the consumers of educational content and educational technology, we are also the producers of it. And, you know, as a consequence, there's certainly room for us as a community to respond very much in the way that file sharers responded. And if it means that we have to be pirates and wear patches over our eyes and go arr a lot and separate international talk like a pirate day, well then so be it. But as Michael said, ultimately, educational institutions, educators, educational technology companies, open source providers need to stick together and need to have a common front on this issue. And one more thing, just so everyone, Michael, when you're speaking, you should speak louder, please. Thank you.
Turning up my mic a bit now, I see a question on the floor about what if Blackboard followed EDUCAUSE's suggestion and dropped the patent suit. Is it too late? Well, I'll give you my answer, and I'm really curious to hear the answers of the folks in the audience. From my perspective, the answer is it is absolutely not too late. I hope I made clear from the beginning that in my perspective, this isn't a Blackboard problem. This is a patent law problem. Blackboard is following the rules of the game as they are spelled out. Okay, we may not like it. We may not like the game. We may think that their particular patent is or is not valid. We may wish that they didn't assert it regardless of its validity. But they're certainly within their legal rights to be doing what they are doing. What we need in absence of the ability to change the law itself, and I believe, frankly, that eventually the law, the problems here, the system's going to collapse under its own weight and there will be reform, but probably not for quite some time and not before there's a whole lot of pain. What we need to do in the meantime is create a covenant with our vendors that says whatever the law says, economically, we're telling you that we expect a certain kind of behavior vis-a-vis IP assertion. We will support you if you demonstrate that kind of behavior, and we will punish you if you don't. If Blackboard were to step forward as the company that was the first to assert an EDGE patent and say, all right, you know what, we're changing course here, and I've been on record on this before, I would be the first to sing their praises, absolutely. We need their help to solve this problem.
I want to turn that around, though, and say it's not just a patent law problem. It's a Blackboard problem, because Blackboard is the company right now that's asserting a patent and suing one of its competitors and scaring the educational institutions and making open source developers nervous and undermining the communal structure that has characterized the development of educational technology from the beginning. And you know, Michael may be the first to welcome Blackboard back into the fold should they change their position. I would be the second, and the only reason why I would be the second is that my newsletter comes out at 5 p.m., and so Michael would probably publish sooner than I would, but I would still publish on the same day. I don't think it's too late for them. I think they've done significant harm to their reputation, and you know, I think that people are picturing them now as a company that's run by the lawyers and the accountants rather than the educators and the developers, and I don't think that that can help the company at all. But you know, I think that if it makes a tangible move toward reconciliation and rapprochement with the rest of the educational community, the community would be welcoming, and I know I certainly would be. You know, it doesn't mean I'll become their biggest fan. You know, I am still Canadian, and I'll probably cheer for our side, if you will. But you know, I won't think of them as the pariah that I think of them right now.
John Mayer threw up a back-channel message to the moderators and asked if we would conduct a quick poll. And the question he wanted to ask is, how many in this audience would, quote, forgive Blackboard if they dropped the suit? And so this is an opportunity to practice using your green check or your red X. I'm going to go ahead and make those anonymous so that you can vote anonymously. So go ahead and vote, if you will, a green check or a red X, and I'll give you just about 15 more seconds to get your vote registered. just the green check or the red X up at the top of your screen. Again, I've made those anonymous. And 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and lock those responses. And now what I'm going to do is push those out. Bear with me here. Let's see here. Polling, and I'm going to publish the stats up to the whiteboard. So we got yes, 37%, no, 7%, and over half of the audience chose not to vote. So not sure, John, if that answered your question or not, but that was the mood of the audience.
Michael Richards, and they have to be sincere.
I'm taking a look at the clock. We've got lots of good conversation, lots of good questions going on. Let me turn to the chat window real quickly. We'll see, moving back here, just a few questions. Let me see. Well, let me start at the bottom here with Barry. How many contract decision makers are in the audience? They are the people who really matter and what hurts Blackboard or not. So if folks could just type into the chat window and let Barry know if you're a decision maker on your campus. That would be helpful. And while you're doing that, let me see if there are any other questions. Well, just in case I missed one, if you do have a question, throw your hand up and we will call on you. I've also been keeping track of several points, and I've got these down here at the bottom of the screen. One of those points, we did talk about legal questions a touch, and it reminded me that Michael had written an article titled Keep Your Own Counsel on the Blackboard Controversy. One of the questions was, what can we do or what should we be doing? Michael, maybe you can just give us the highlights of that article and what you recommended in it.
Sure. Well, the article, it's important to have context for that article. It came out relatively early in the in this whole business when we didn't have any legal experts who had weighed in publicly yet. And so what the article was is really a series of questions that I recommended that you take to your university's general counsel. And I don't have the URL handy, but it was in Campus Technologies C-Level View. And they were questions like, can you give me a simple litmus test to see whether technologies on our campus might infringe? If they may infringe, what is our liability exposure? What advice would you give to someone who is developing a homegrown system today in light of this patent? It mentions a couple other patents and cycles through the same questions, including Blackboard's pending patent about university portal and content system. I think it might have referenced eCollege's patent on online gradebooks. And then ask some questions such as, what can happen in an environment in which multiple patents are asserted, and so on and so forth. I really think that this is, if you want to start a conversation with your university, the purpose of that article was to ask some questions that are likely to get your general counsel's attention. And I really recommend getting those questions in the hands of legal counsel, because they will tell you, I mean, look, I'm not a lawyer. You shouldn't trust what I have to say about your liability exposure. And when I say your liability exposure, I mean both your campus and you personally. If you contribute to an open source project, or you develop software that might infringe, whether it's commercial, homegrown, or open source, I mean, there are at least theoretical liability exposures that you need to know about.
And let me push that just a little further, just in this general, what can we do, what should we be doing as the educational community, besides talking to our legal counsel? Stephen, why don't you go first, and Michael, if you could follow up, What other actions should we be taking as a community to address these concerns?
Is to be vocal. First of all, directly with Blackboard, to let Blackboard know what you think of their actions, to send the message directly to them and do it in a public way so it's also seen by their shareholders so that they can see the negative publicity. I've seen people, prefacing their talks. They go give a talk at a conference, and the first slide that they show is a slide, and I'll run it on my website later, don't patent things you didn't invent and that sort of thing. Spread the word to people who, like most of the world, have utterly no interest in educational technology, because that spreads the concern about this issue beyond our own small community. The other thing that you should do, and you'll find that this is happening in Canada now, is lobby politically. Make it clear to your elected representatives that the patent regime that allows a company like Blackboard to simply file a few papers and create a multi-million dollar damage, which may or may not be with any merit to some other company. There's something fundamentally wrong with that sort of setup. And, it was just today I saw the news article that in Britain, legislators resisted the movement to have the copyright protection on music extended to 95 years. It's going to remain at 50 years. So this kind of lobbying can be successful. In Canada, it may result in making the Blackboard patents invalid in the sense that they will never be granted at all. The intervention may be filed in enough time so that we'll be an LMS haven. We'll be the Cayman Islands of the LMS community. Develop your stuff here and be free of the Blackboard patent. Well, maybe not, but I digress. And the third thing is, don't simply back down. When challenged, work together with other institutions, with other developers, with other educators, so that if a company like Blackboard challenges one of us, it challenges all of us. And this is something that should be clear, even with the current lawsuit. It's not my perception that Desire to Learn is standing all by its lonesome against Blackboard in this. What I've seen is a rallying of support to the company from people who might not normally support commercial companies or LMS companies or whatever. And, I think that this kind of response is going to be very important, and to understand that it's not the individual company that is being sued in a lawsuit like this. It's the entire community that is being sued, and therefore the entire community must work together in response. So essentially, be vocal, lobby for change in the legislation, and don't back down in the face of intimidation, because it's like any bully. I mean, they will eventually have to back down with their threats, because ultimately when they're bullying, it's because they don't have the substance to back up what the product that they're trying to put into the marketplace. That's my opinion anyways.
Yeah, I actually have a couple of slides on this. First of all, let's see. In the short term, the most important thing that you can do if you're a Blackboard customer is complain. Blackboard does care about losing customers, as any company does. And you have to. It has to be. First of all, It has to be frank, and it has to have some teeth in it. It has to be believable. I think we all know in the university environment, there's a lot of complaining that goes on about a lot of topics. Some of it is tied to potential action, and some of it isn't. So particularly if you have an otherwise good relationship with Blackboard, if you're otherwise satisfied with their product or with their customer service, it's important to say, look, you know, we'd like to work with you, but this is an issue that we're going to have to consider when we make our decisions. And there are ways you can demonstrate that to them. You can drag your feet on signing your renewal. You can drag your feet on signing for the upgrade that you're thinking about getting. Or even tell them you're not going to upgrade until this is resolved. You can, when your contract is up for renewal, even if you think you're likely to renew, you can start looking around and at least do a basic review of other products on the market before you make the absolute decision to renew. I'm a realist about this. I understand that doing a migration is a very, very serious business. And I don't expect people to jump in. I wish they would, but I understand that not all organizations are ready to do that in protest. But I think it's important to start showing signs that you are preparing for the eventuality down the road that you would move on. And of course, if you're already starting to look in earnest, look at other options and really make this a buying criterion for your organization. You can also work with your professional and industry associations. I think the EDUCAUSE letter was very powerful. It got a lot of people's attention. It was courageous also, I'll say, unprecedented. If you are in a union, if you are in a community college association or some other kind of professional association, see if you can get them to write a letter. Another thing you can do, and this is one of my personal causes that I'm flogging, is the Digital Promise, the Digital Opportunity Investment Trust Act. This is a bill in the United States that's in both houses of Congress, which if passed would pump something like $1 billion a year into the development of open educational software and open educational content. And you know, one way to reduce, not eliminate, but reduce the EDUPatent threat is to just put so much money into innovation that you've just your way out ahead of the proprietaries to say, look, you know, this was clearly out on the market first, establish a lot of prior art. $1 billion a year can do a hell of a lot of good in that regard, and as well as in many other regards. So if you're a United States citizen, I urge you to go to digitalpromise.org to the Take Action page and use that page to write to your congressmen and senators, and write to them again if they change in January, depending on your district. Some other longer-term things to think about. This is advice from Dan Ravitcher, and Dan Ravitcher is a lawyer for the Software Freedom Law Center. He works for Eben Mogul, and the author of the GPL. So he's hardly, he's about as hardcore as you get in terms of these issues. And he, as Stephen suggested, he says that you have to support structural patent reform. Patent disputes may be resolved in the spirit of open source licensing. We're seeing a number of large companies like IBM stepping up and Novell stepping up and donating patents to a patent pool to protect open source software. That need not be confined to open source software. It could be educational software, which is what I would favor, regardless of whether it's open source. You can contribute to databases of previously inaccessible prior art. This is something we have a lot of work to do on now around EDUPatents. The Wikipedia page was a good start, but that's all it is. It's a good start. Be prepared to design around patents. So when a patent is issued, you can look at your product, have a lawyer look at your product for about $10,000. A project or company can have a lawyer do the work necessary to issue what's known as an opinion of non-infringement, which I think is fairly protective fairly good inoculation against patent suits. And if the lawyer comes back and tells you, well, I can't issue you an opinion of non-infringement, here's because you do infringe, then he can help you figure out, if there's a workaround. Obviously, that is of limited value eventually. The amount of working around you need to do becomes very destructive, but it is a strategy to be aware of. Obtain patent infringement defense insurance. So this is, I think, something that is going to increasingly become a reality, whether we like it or not. Until the laws change, institutions and individuals, to a certain degree, need to think about indemnification. I know I'm going on about this, but it's important. So let me just go on a bit longer here. For open source projects, it's going to be, I mentioned the non-infringement opinion and the design around. You needn't do that for every patent, but certainly for patents that are being asserted or enforced. It's very, very important, more important than ever, to maintain and publish complete documentation of the design processes and contributions, not just for prior art, but also to protect contributors. If necessary, this is another unpleasant reality. You know, open source projects may be forced to seek license agreements with patent holders. This wouldn't be my first choice, obviously, or second or third, but there are going to be cases in which it's unavoidable. If you are a contributor to open source software, make sure your contribution is given to a legal entity. You want your software to have some kind of a foundation around it, and retain a non-exclusive license to use and distribute. That will protect you from lawsuits to a certain degree. Execute a written contribution agreement. More and more open source projects are doing this. Maintain a list of your contributions and copies of the contributions themselves, and think about what Stephen said earlier about the overhead cost now. This is really what you need to do. Publish or otherwise evidence date and validity of documents. You want to prove that you did what you, not only that you did what you did, but that you did it when you said you did it. Evaluate carefully if the organization and or project is protecting your interests before participating or contributing, and verify a written policy that they will notify you of any possible patent or copyright infringement when it is learned.
Well, this is kind of an odd moment for me to jump in and push the survey, but I have noticed that we're just about 5 minutes over time for all of the right reasons. It's been a fantastic conversation, and let me invite everyone to stick around because there are three major topics which I certainly want to throw out if our speakers are willing to stick around for a minute. So you're all invited to stay, but with respect to all of your time, because I know it is getting late this evening, I want to quickly push out a survey, so bear with me for just a second. Here comes the URL. Okay, you should be seeing it in just a second, and there it is on your screen. If you would just click on Get Started, you'll see that it's just a less than a 10-question survey. If you just fill this out quickly, this is of great help to us at OLN so that we can make these online seminars better and bring more of them to you. And we do hope that you continue to come back to the TeachU website and sign up for additional sessions. So that's kind of my final thing I want to make sure that everybody does. I do have, I think, three major areas that I'd like to open up. One is that we've got representatives from both Blackboard and Desire to Learn in the room, and they've been very kind to limit their participation to listening thus far. But I do want to provide them an opportunity to discuss, present their side of this, and add to the great conversation that we've been having, and certainly provide them an opportunity to do that. I think you'll find that very interesting. Second agenda item that I have is to really open the mic. We've been doing a lot of the talking, the two speakers and myself, and we would like to open it up so that you could ask questions. And the third point, and this is where I'd like to start, is I'd like to push Michael just a little bit more and about changing power structures. And full disclosure, I heard Michael and Stephen give it was a podcast that was done on EdTech Talk, and I thought that one of the most exciting comments in that discussion was when Stephen was talking about how power structures were changing. And if I recall correctly, and Stephen, correct me if I'm wrong, he talked about several things that were changing. One was content publishing, and that we were moving from a publisher-centric model, and we're starting to see open content initiatives happen. We talked a little bit about that. Certainly, we've talked about open source initiatives versus standard commercial software, and that was somewhat of a change. But one of the most interesting changes that Stephen talked about, and I'd like to hear him talk more about this, is the idea that with these Web 2.0 technologies, that there's a sea change occurring in the power structure that exists between teacher and student, and more particular between institution and student, and that with blogs and wikis and podcasting and video production and audio production, that students now bring with them to the institutions additional capabilities and literacies that enable them to be producers of information in a different way than they ever have been able to before. And Stephen, without stealing your fire, let me turn it over to you and get you to push this idea a little bit further.
Well, you can steal all the fire you want. So it's not my fire. And I thought you were doing a pretty good job explaining it. I was asked at an OECD meeting how I would go about furnishing the large numbers of open educational resources that would be needed in the future in order to provide free access to learning resources for everybody in the world. And my response was, well, get the students to do them. It's quite true. You look at the technologies that are in the hands of not just students but everybody today, and it has become possible to produce quite high quality resources, whether they be videos or audio casts or text-based materials or animations or whatever, quite high quality materials, and you don't need to be an expert in order to do this. And my thinking was, even if you have 99 bad resources produced by students, you might still have one good resource produced by students, and that's one resource you didn't have before when you had professional publishers doing it. And there's an awful lot of students, so you don't need a high success rate in order to be successful getting students to publish things. But I think more significantly, and I hinted at this a bit earlier in the discussion, I think that because we are so much more easily able to document what it is that we do, whether we are plumbers or welders or politicians or lawyers or accountants or software developers, because we can document what we do and because we participate in this community, this online community of exchange and practice, and can do so in an open way, we as practitioners of the various arts are able to take over and to contribute to a large amount of the teaching responsibilities in that discipline. So we've always separated, and we've done it for good reason, the discipline the practice of teaching and learning about a subject and the practice of practicing the subject. But now as technologies make it more and more possible to communicate and do at the same time, the justification and the the need for this separation becomes less and less. And we don't need so much people who specialize only in teaching. Rather, we can have people who specialize in whatever it is that they do, and through our support and through the affordances made possible by this technology, also become good teachers. So, yeah, I think it does change the relation of the learner and the teacher. I think it changes in the sense that the learner is no longer, how do I want to put this? I mean, it's always been the case where, you know, the institution provides the service and the learner consumes the service, even though, you know, the act of consuming the service can be fairly hard and the institution judges the consumer to see if they're found wanting. But more and more institutions are going to be changing their role from being providers of this service to agencies that help learners provide this service for themselves. In other words, agencies that don't simply teach topics. I don't want to be hackneyed here and say, well, they teach them, you know, how to learn and all of that. But I do want to say that they provide the infrastructure and the resources and the support that allow people to teach themselves whatever it is that they're interested in according to their own interests, their own tastes, their own pace, their own context. And I really think that this will change what we think of as education today, and it will change the sort of technology that we are going to consider appropriate in support of teaching and learning. And I hope that is sort of what you were expecting.
It was great. Thank you. Michael, did you have anything to add before we jump agenda items? Michael, lost your audio there for a minute. Go ahead and try it again.
Trying again. Can you hear me now? Good. What I was going to say is that some of these ideas are actually quite ancient. You know, the idea of sort of learning by doing. What you're talking about is almost a kind of an apprenticeship approach, going into a journeyman approach, and it's certainly true that a lot of technologies that are at our disposal today make that a lot more easy and interesting and rich. I was having a conversation with some folks the other day at a SUNY conference. Beth Harris and Steven Zucker from FIT, who run the wonderful Smart History weblog at smarthistory .org weblog, and their colleague Eric Feinblatt. And they were talking about having students create, do essentially what Stephen was talking about, dividing students into teams with specialists, a media specialist and a research specialist, and so on, and getting them to go out and do some research on the web to put together class materials, and that they would in fact be teaching the course, in essence, and that one of the teachers' jobs really is to help them learn how to replace the teacher. And one suggestion that I made, and this just kind of drives the point home of the opportunities that are out there, one suggestion I made was, well, once the students have the content produced, why not just put it in Merlot and let the normal social rating process that goes on of teacher utilization and teacher reviews and so on of the content produced by the students act as a kind of distributed portfolio evaluation method. And brought to its logical conclusion, as Stephen points out, that the dividing line between teachers and students becomes fuzzier and fuzzier, or to think of it another way, the kind of work that goes on in graduate education, where you're teaching the graduate student to be a disciplinarian, to see things through the lens of discipline, teaching them how to think in a particular way rather than, particular content so much. You're extending that down to the undergraduate level and, possibly below that. I think that's absolutely what's going on, and I do agree that there are some challenges, some very serious challenges to doing that in the current sort of learning management platforms that we have. They're just not conceived of this way. So we have some very serious work to do in terms of unbolting the chairs.
And I saw Stephen mentioned that they may just post it in institutional repository. And just one quick note, the state of Ohio is currently building a statewide object repository that would be used to support all institutions in the state of Ohio so that content would not any longer need to be maintained in the silos of various institutions of higher education's content repositories or even in their course management systems, but rather individual students or faculty or staff or what have you would be able to post their content and then set permissions, rights management as they saw fit to share it across the state or beyond. With that, let me close down this part of the discussion and move us over to our folks from Blackboard and Desire to Learn. First off, I'm not sure who's here, if anyone's still from Desire to Learn. If you are from Desire to Learn, if you could raise your hand and identify yourself, that would be helpful. I see that Matt Small from Blackboard is still in the audience, or if you'd like to type something in. I'm not seeing anyone. Let me ask Matt if he'd like to say anything or type anything in the chat room. Matt, the floor is yours. And I see Matt typing, and Michael tells me that Diane Lark is here as well. While Matt's typing, Diane, if you've got a mic, I'm sorry, Lank, thank you very much. Diane, if you have a mic and have any comments, go ahead and grab the microphone. Okay, well, I can see that Matt Small says he's happy to answer any questions. That's a nice offer. Thank you, Matt, and I think Diane is has a slow connection, so it looks like Diane's okay on chat. Does anyone have any questions for either Matthew Small or for Diane? And if someone could let me know Diane's position at Desire to Learn, that would be helpful. So I open it up to the audience or to our two speakers if they thank you. So we have general counsel from both companies, very helpful. Any questions for either of these folks? This is an opportunity you may not have again. Great. Stephen asks, I want to know what it will take to have Blackboard drop the lawsuit. Matt, I think that one's for you. Just so everybody's got their eyes in the right spot, there is chat happening in the chat window. And it looks like Matt Small's checking his mic to see if he can get it to work. Matt, anytime you're ready.
Matt, anytime you're ready.
Can you hear me? I assume that yes was that you can hear me. Oh, good. Wasn't sure if this would work. I appreciate the question, Stephen, and I guess good to meet you via Illuminate. But, I think there's a lot of opinion around, what the patent claims to invent or doesn't claim to invent. And yes, I believe that Blackboard invented, what the patent claims to invent. I don't believe that we invented the CMS. I don't believe that we invented, the applications up on the Wikipedia site. I don't believe we invented e-learning. Probably not the right forum to get into, our interpretation of the patent. I know that, Michael Feldstein had posted several legal experts who commented on the opinion. Of course, we also talked to our legal experts. I dare say that they have spent much more time and effort really digging into the issue, many more hours than the other folks who have commented. And I know Desire to Learn has competent counsel, and I'm sure that they've looked into it and they have a differing opinion. But I you know, wouldn't bring the action if I didn't believe that, you know, it was justifiable. And I think, you know, Mike said, you know, Scott Michael Feldstein said something that, you know, I think it's true. You know, Blackboard is following the rules of the game as they're laid out, and I think there is plenty of room for a very vigorous discussion around whether the current U.S. patent law is, you know, the way it should be, whether it should be changed, whether the rules for software patents should be. But given, you know, what they are now, and given what companies' rights are now, and given the amount of money and effort and risk that the folks at Blackboard took, you know, I don't think it is a necessarily, you know, evil action, as it's been portrayed, for Blackboard to seek a reasonable royalty for the use of its intellectual property. And, you know, I'm certainly not trying to convince you. I know you'll disagree. I've read your site, which, you know, I think is a great site, by the way. You know, I think that we'll probably just disagree on that. I don't think it's, you know, Blackboard is not going to drop the suit. I think that, you know, when you talk about alternatives, you know, it's important really to put yourself in the boardroom of a public company and decide, you know, what, you know, is what companies do and don't do, what shareholders expect. You know, certainly we listen very closely to the debate that's out there. We've listened to clients. I myself have had discussions with hundreds of clients. I think, you know, the group presenting on this call has, you know, one somewhat a unified view on the patent action. It's an opposing view. There's definitely other views out there. People don't tend to post the favorable views. I think, you know, Blackboard does not want to hinder innovation. I agree with you. That would be a bad thing. We don't want to hurt open source. We don't want to hurt, you know, our clients and universities and teaching and learning. I think we all have the same mission in mind. I think the way the people at Blackboard are being perceived externally is very different from the way they perceive themselves. I mean, it's a company where people care deeply about teaching and learning and the impact of e-learning, and it is difficult to see the negative PR, you know, around the suit for several reasons. And, you know, there's a lot of PR work certainly to be done by Blackboard, but it doesn't change the premise that, you know, we believe that we invented these things. We believe it's our right to seek a reasonable royalty against a commercial for-profit competitor. That's a long-winded answer to your question. I see there's other things up here, but Cable, I don't want to usurp this. Do you want me to try to answer the other comments, or do you want me to, you know, let you take open the mic again?
Well, thank you, Matt. I appreciate that, and I think we're really in an open mic session. Thanks for giving up the mic temporarily. Let me invite Diane from Desire to Learn if she does have a mic. She did mention she had a slow connection, so if a mic doesn't work, that's fine. But Diane, I did want to give you equal time. Even if you wanted to type in some chat comments, please feel free to do so. Or if you do have a mic and would like to try that, you're more than welcome to do that as well.
I'll continue, and if anyone, feel free to cut me off in the chat box. You know, there's several things, you know, being written as I talk here, and, you know, I don't want to, you know, out people who say things to me in confidence or who talk to Blackboard, but, you know, I just ask you for a moment, and again, I'm not trying to convince anyone, but to put yourselves in the shoes of the founders who, you know, undergraduate students in their early 20s, working with professors. You know, they weren't part of the larger e-learning community. They certainly weren't, you know, part of, you know, the e-learning thinking that was going on at the time. They were responding to requests that their teachers had. They came up with a better mousetrap, and, you know, they said, you know, how can we change this to make it work better for the professors, and, you know, they made changes, they invested, they leveraged everything they had. I mean, they really, you know, bet the farm on it. They leveraged credit cards, they came here, I'm more familiar with the actual details of the invention story than we've made public, and there's reasons we can't, you know, publicize the whole thing. It will certainly come out in the trial, but they, you know, took risk, and it was received well by the market, and they, you know, filed for patent protection at the time because they didn't want someone to come in and pick up where they left off and take advantage of all their trial and error. And you know, today I think it's, you know, easy to look at the detriments of patents, and, you know, God knows I've received letters from trolls. I've received letters from patents that I thought were invalid. You know, I hate receiving those letters. Blackboard pays royalties, you know, for patents and for other intellectual property. Some of the most aggressive enforcers of these are universities. Some of the universities that were represented by people on this call tonight, I mean, I'm sure that people aren't even aware of what their technology licensing offices are doing. You know, I think our patent's distinguishable from those others, because I do, you know, I am familiar with the facts, and do think that, you know, we are doing this in good faith, and we're not doing it to hurt innovation or other people, and, you know, we'll do what we can to get that message out and to put people at ease and to continue innovating and, you know, hopefully win back, you know, the goodwill of, you know, a lot of people who I think are offended by the patent. But the overall, the majority of the client base out there, I don't think is represented by the attendees of this, or at least the presenters of this session. I think many people out there say, okay, we want a stable commercial vendor that will indemnify us, that will invest, that will listen to us and continue to invest in their product. And if they need to file for patent protection to make these investments so that someone can't come on the scene, you know, later with recent development tools and a little bit of venture money and pick up where they left off without, you know, any protection at all, you know, so be it, as long as they don't do their action to do anything and, you know, come after schools and come after open source and, you know, interfere with not-for-profit entities. There's been a lot written here since I've been talking. David, you asked, you know, am I claiming that looking to something for a long time makes me right? No, but the reality is, if you got a patent from someone tomorrow, you could call a law firm within 48 hours for $20,000, get a non-infringement opinion by telling them your side of the story, and they make assumptions in the opinion, you can get it. And what that will give you is, you know, you'll be able to claim that there's no willful infringement and therefore no treble damages later. And that's kind of a common practice. So you can't put too much stock in it when someone says, we have a legal opinion that it's not valid, because validity is a very expensive, very time-consuming process to show. And, you know, we haven't even gotten into that in our own case. And, you know, as I said, we believe it's valid. You know, can you point to a non-Blackboard favorable view? I mean, I think that, you know, there are, point you to a non-Blackboard favorable view? I mean, sure, I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of those in this discussion tonight. You know, there are a lot of non-Blackboard favorable views. In fact, I wish that the panel, I think you know, Stephen and Michael did a good job, and I appreciate you, you know, putting this on, but I had hoped there would be more of the opposing view, more of, hey, here's what Blackboard might be thinking, here's the other side, here what it means, you know. There are larger companies, much larger than Blackboard, who've long been talking about coming into this space, and, you know, would it be irresponsible for Blackboard to try not to test the patent in the space, or bring an enforcement action, or seek intellectual, you know, property protection. Barry Dahl asked, Matthew, can you see how Blackboard's actions are not considered kosher by the education community? Does that make sense to you? We don't like being fun and corporate shenanigans. Barry, I wouldn't describe it as corporate shenanigans, although I certainly see why people might not view it as kosher. I think it's really hard with patents to know exactly what is being claimed, what's not, what exactly was the invalidating prior art. You know, is there prior art out there? You know, sure, there's a difference in saying, you know, is it invalidating prior art, or is the prior art that's out there more material than what the PTO cited against Blackboard at the time, which is the standard of, you know, what you're supposed to submit. And, you know, everyone always thinks, oh, I can think of 100 things that would invalidate this patent, but they may not be looking at all 44 claims. They may not be thinking about, well, actually, what version of the thing that I'm thinking about was actually out at what time? Was it published? Does it do exactly what the patent says? I mean, it's a fine-tuned analysis. I think, you know, for those people who think that Blackboard's claiming to have invented the CMS or e-learning, you know, that's offensive. And I think people who think that we're doing that, you know, are offended. And I would be if that's what we're claiming, but we're not. Dave, you asked, you know that your personal community of one, two, if you include your cat, are very interested. Diane, you know, Matt's company might disagree. I mean, certainly, Diane and I obviously disagree. And, you know, I understand Diane's position, and, you know, I think she's representing her client well, as certainly I have no doubt that she'll continue to do, but, you know, we just disagree on this one. Dave asks, Mr. Small, we aren't hippies necessarily, who are going to be converted by a story. I believe the prior art exists. The fact they've leveraged credit cards is not particularly relevant. Well, I don't believe people, you know, I don't believe you're hippies, and I don't believe I'm going to convert you by my story. However, I do believe if the invention story and the founder story is relevant. Stephen says that note that the founders have already made a lot of money. Note the stock sales on the public record. It's not like they've been compensated. I don't know what that link takes me to, but I know that the CEO hasn't received $10 million.
Matt, if I may,
sorry to cut you off.
No problem. Please do. I was just retrying to get through all the comments.
Well, folks, this is Cable, your moderator, and I've received several back-channel messages from folks who really do find this interesting and want to be part of an ongoing conversation, but have reminded me that we are almost approaching an hour over time, and that we are past 9 o'clock Eastern time, and I know that all of us need to work tomorrow. And so in the interest of all of yours and my hours of sleep tonight, what I would suggest is that we probably have more to chew on than we can accomplish in one evening. I'd like to give my sincere thanks to our moderator, or our speakers tonight. Both Michael and Stephen did just a fabulous job, and you'll see that you can click on your hands and give them a round of applause there. And also want to thank Matt for his comments afterwards. Really appreciate you coming, Matt, and Diane from D2L as well. And if this group would like to see a second session, please feel free to send me an email, and we can talk about what that might look like. I'm going to go ahead and type in my email address now to the chat window. It's cgreen@oln.org. And with that, I thank you all. I wish you a good night, and thanks again for coming.
Just say one thing, Kimmel, just in response to the statement that there wasn't a balanced presentation here, and Blackboard was invited to respond to my column in Innovate that's coming out December 1st and didn't do that. And I may be doing an online session with Innovate over that column, and I would certainly invite them to come and discuss the issue with them. I'm very open to talking with them in a public forum, and I'm sure Michael is quite willing to do so. And my experience has been that it has been Blackboard that has been picking and choosing. So I think it's a bit much for them to say that they have not been given the chance to comment. So anytime, any place, you guys, we'll go.
Well, thank you, folks, and just a reminder that this entire session has been archived, and I will make it available on the TGU website within the next 48 hours, and you'll be able to access it there. And the other quick question is, if anybody did not get a chance to fill out the online survey, Again, if you'll just send me an email to cgreen@oln.org, I'll make sure that you get a copy. Thanks very much. Happy evening to you all.